Good morning and happy Monday, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the very first episode of the Defiant Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Majid Padelan, a.k.a. Brooklyn Dad Defiant. You know the old saying, opinions are like assholes, everyone's got one? The same holds true for podcasts. I read somewhere recently that there are 10,000 new podcasts every week. 10,000. Think of the collective noise of all those voices talking all at once. For those of you who know me, all 1.3 million of you in the Brooklyn Dad Defiant Army, hello, howdy, bonjour, hola, guten tag, salamu alaikum, shalom, aloha. For the rest, you are likely wondering, who the hell is this Brooklyn Dad guy? Why is he defiant? And what's the point of this podcast? Well, I'm glad you asked that. So first things first, Brooklyn. I wasn't born and raised in Brooklyn, but Brooklyn is where I became an adult. It's where I got my adulting badge. It's where I became a real dad. And folks, being a dad is everything to me. My dadness is the most important thing about me, and it's what I'm most proud of. I have a total of 5 children, 3 fully grown sons, and a teenage son and daughter. Being a dad is kind of my approach to life, where I feel a responsibility to speak up because I want to pass a better world onto my kids. It's why I became such a prominent voice with 1.3 million followers on Twitter. Fun fact, most folks know me on Twitter as Brooklyn Dad Defiant, but I didn't start out that way. In June of 2016, I had 60 followers and tweeted maybe once or twice a week. But suddenly, the Republican Party nominated the worst person possible, Donald Trump, and something in me just clicked. I saw the danger, and it made me furious that Republicans didn't. I started tweeting furiously like 5 or 6 times a day, and the anger in my tweets was palpable. After a month, I had 2,000 followers, and then 7,000, and then 15,000. I had found my voice, and it was resonating with people. I changed my name to Brooklyn Dad for Hillary. Next thing you know, it's November 9th, and the unthinkable happened. Trump won. I was disappointed, I was confused, scared, all the feelings. But then I popped into one of my DM, you know, direct message groups, where I found a lot of the folks who I had participated in with tweet storms, and they were saying, well, that's it. I'm going to pack it in and hide because the trolls are going to come for me. And that made me more furious than Trump winning. Like, we have the biggest threat our democracy has ever faced taking over the White House, and now you want to quit? This is when we need you the most, to fight. I immediately found a picture of President Obama sticking his middle finger in Trump's face, and I changed my profile picture to that before eventually switching to the picture I have now. More importantly, I changed my name to Brooklyn Dad Defiant. People think the defiant is because I was defying Trump or defying the power. Nope, I was defying the malaise, the defeatism, the despair. And now we face similar stakes. We're looking at 6 or 7 crucial, critical months in which to make our case to the American people who've seemingly developed what I can only call a vexing case of selective amnesia. But I haven't forgotten the insanity. I'm old enough to remember when he was impeached for trying to extort the president of Ukraine, and then he was impeached because he incited a fucking insurrection at the Capitol and did nothing about it for 187 minutes. I remember him lying to the American people about COVID, saying that it would just go away like magic in the spring. He said China had it under control. He said perhaps we could look into treating COVID with disinfectant or UV lights. I could go on, and I will go on. Not today, but in the course of days, weeks, and months ahead, we're going to make sure everyone knows what they need to know. We're going to drop some reminders, and we're going to illuminate some new facts. We're going to fight for our democracy. And we're not going to get mad. We're going to get defiant. First, though, a few words. I don't know who needs to hear this, but when you pass the buck back to the states on abortion, it doesn't absolve you of the fact that you have turned back the clock for millions of Americans, criminalizing a choice that has been guaranteed for decades. For most, it was settled law. The fact of the matter is that Donald Trump did this.
Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and, in fact, demanded be ended, Roe v. Wade.
But now in Arizona, the dog has caught the bus with a draconian ruling that is so absurd it could be an onion headline if it weren't true. And this has left Republicans, including Donald Trump, twisting themselves into knots to distance themselves from the ruling, saying it goes too far. Sorry, folks, when you let the genie out of the bottle and he takes a shit on the floor, it's still your mess to clean up. The irony of this situation is that moves like this that threaten to turn the country into the Handmaid's Tale are actually good news for Democrats. Hear me out. In an election cycle where President Biden has had difficulty making his case for a second term, extremist moves like this will help mobilize the grassroots of this party. Arizona is only the most prominent of dozens of states where abortion is likely to remain front and center in November. Between continued bans on the procedure, a steady drumbeat of legal rulings, and painful personal stories of women affected by the restrictions, and ballot measures asking voters whether to expand rights and access. The New Yorker's Susan Glasser calls it, quote, the abortion news paradox. In the post-Roe era, every crazy court decision, every extremist vote by a Republican-controlled state legislature actually helps the Democrats politically in the upcoming election. That doesn't mean it's not scary as hell in the meantime and terrible for millions of women who are affected as a result. Republican strategists are terrified, as they should be. This could be what turns Arizona blue. But it's also a terrible precedent. Is that what it takes to wake people up to the reality of what a Trump presidency means? What other freedoms do we have to lose before people start paying attention? Oh, and one more thing. Raise your hand if you think that Republican extremists parroting Russian propaganda on the floor of the House of Representatives is something that should terrify most Americans.
Admiral Stavridis, House Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Turner says he's heard some of his Republican colleagues repeat Russian propaganda on the House floor. Let's take a look at his new remarks.
We see directly coming from Russia attempts to mask communications that are anti-Ukraine and pro-Russia messages, some of which we even hear being uttered on the House floor.
Because that's what's happening right now, especially as it relates to the war in Ukraine and the weird crush that the far right has on Putin.
With PUC News last week, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McFaul said, quote, I think Russian propaganda has made its way into the United States, unfortunately, and it's infected a good chunk of my party's base.
Hashtag Moscow Marjorie has become a trending topic on Twitter.
We're not the fringe. We are the base of the party.
Ukraine just kept poking the bear and poking the bear. There is no win for Ukraine here. Russia is being very successful in their invasion.
We're not the fringe. We are the base of the party.
Can we give a round of applause for Russia?
We're not the fringe. We are the base of the party.
Remember that Zelensky is a thug. Remember that the Ukrainian government is incredibly corrupt and it is incredibly evil.
We're not the fringe. We are the base of the party.
This is genius. Putin declares a big portion of Ukraine. Putin declares it as independent. How smart is that? And he's going to go in and be a peacekeeper.
We're not the fringe.
Scared yet? You should be. My next guest is Frank Figluzzi, who is a national security contributor and regular columnist for NBC News and MSNBC. He also spent 25 years with the FBI as the Assistant Director for Counterintelligence, directing all espionage investigations. He knows a thing or two about Russian propaganda and the danger of this nonsense. Check out his latest book, Long Haul, which has been hailed as a true crime masterpiece by writer Don Winslow and is a shocking journey to the dark side of America's highways, revealing the FBI highway serial killings initiative's hunt for the long-haul truckers behind an astonishing 850 murders and counting. He joins us today to talk about Moscow Marjorie and how the GOP has become the party of Putin, as well as discuss the coming right-wing violence precipitated by Trump and his MAGA flunkies. This is one hell of a conversation, and I promise you won't be disappointed. Frank, thank you so much for joining us here on the Defiant podcast. It's an honor to have you here.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. I enjoy your work, so to speak, on social media, and didn't expect to have someone reach out to me, but I'm glad we could do it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm a big fan of yours as well, and everything that you have done in the past for America and continue to do. So thank you for that.
We're all trying, aren't we? We're all trying in our own way that we, whatever we can do.
Indeed. I want to jump right in. I'd like to start today by talking about Republican House Intelligence Chair Mike Turner's complaints that several of his GOP colleagues have repeated Russian propaganda on the House floor. So unpack for me what it is that's being said by whom and why.
If you're out there thinking, boy, I can no longer tell the difference between what some U.S. elected officials are saying and what's coming out of the Kremlin in Moscow, you would be correct. And it's been confirmed by the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. This is serious business. I, as an FBI counterintelligence leader, and I retired as the head of counterintelligence at the FBI, I frequently briefed the House and Senate. In fact, I would paint them as the most serious committees in Congress. By that, by serious, I mean they really get the mission and they get the most sensitive classified briefings of any Congress members. And they usually take a very nonpartisan or bipartisan approach to intelligence and national security, as, by the way, we all should, right?
That's what you want. You want
national security is not a political topic. But we managed to turn it into that. So when the Republican head of the House Intel Committee says publicly, my Republican colleagues, are echoing Russian talking points directly from Russia, we should pay attention to that. And he specifically, the context there was he was specifically referring to Ukraine and this whole issue of whether the U.S. should continue to financially support the war against Russia and support Ukraine. And I've often sat back at home, read and watched statements by people on the committee, and people, by the way, not on the committee. So, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, almost daily says Ukraine is evil. You know, who knows? They eat babies. I don't, you know, every day. Matt Gaetz glared at President Zelensky when he walked into the House floor to address Congress, glared at him like he was evil. And then all of these little bits and pieces that we have to be very careful about accepting as true because they keep coming at us, like Ukraine government's totally corrupt. We've lost track of hardware and material that we've sent them. Not true, not true. Fixed, problems are fixed. There's no accountability on either side, the U.S. side and the DOD, the Pentagon, and the Ukraine side, there's no accountability. No, not true. Not true. There's accountability with the DOD Inspector General's Office for the United States. And then similarly on the other end, and there's audits and accountability there. So don't buy into the fact that you keep hearing this mantra repeated because it's coming straight from the Kremlin. Another thing we keep hearing is this is a, quote, forever war. We'll be in this forever. We've got to end this now. No, it will actually be a forever war if we don't decisively win this with Ukraine. And, you know, and the other thing that we keep hearing is, Russia used to have these territories and we should just let Ukraine give them back. No, Ukraine is a free people, freely elected, that wants to continue to be free. So we should be supporting and championing that around the globe when it's in our interest. And lastly, let me just add, we're helping Ukraine now because we don't want American boots on the ground tomorrow.
That's right.
If they win now, we don't have to rise up and defend Poland, Sweden, Finland, I don't know, keep going, Eastern Europe, because rest assured, Putin will take Eastern Europe, which, by the way, is another lie that certain Republicans in Congress keep repeating. Oh, Putin has no intentions to take over Eastern Europe. Because, oh, bullshit. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. So that's what the head of the Intel Committee in the House is telling us. His colleagues are disappointing him. They're repeating Russian talking points, which Brooklyn begs a question, right? Which is, why? Why?
You know, Frank, the first time I heard somebody say they're fighting the war over there so we don't have to, I mean, it made quick sense to me. I mean, I'm not much for foreign policy, but that was right over the plate. That made perfect sense to me. Earlier you mentioned that Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing her share of, you know, spreading Russian misinformation or disinformation. She was just trending yesterday on Twitter as Moscow Marjorie. Now, there's not a lot of people in the political realm who take her all that seriously. Is it a mistake for us to dismiss her?
No, do not dismiss all these names I've rattled off and even Marjorie Taylor Greene, because they control their little corner of social media, and the message keeps being permeated throughout social media. And what we've caught Russia and China doing, and there's been recent reporting on this from NBC News, is they'll take a statement like from Marjorie Taylor Greene or someone like her, someone that doesn't deserve a particular amount of attention, and then those foreign intelligence services will amplify it across social media. So she has an immediate amplifying support out there. She knows when she spouts something ridiculous that there's going to be foreign adversaries who blow up her message so that we can't help but avoid it. And she's got to have people on her team telling her, hey, this is resonating like crazy. Well, let me tell you, it's resonating like crazy because foreign powers who are against us are absolutely amplifying it as a tactic and a strategy on social media.
In your mind, what's the link between Russian disinformation and the GOP far right? Like the House Foreign Affairs Chairman Michael McCaul says that it has infected a good chunk of my party's base.
Yeah. As I said, even me, who worked the Russian target as a counterintelligence agent for many years, and I'm very familiar with the fact that Russian intelligence officers get out of bed every day with the intention of harming us and our interests. There's a lot there that's very similar. As I said, even me, I found it difficult to discern whether I heard this from, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene or whether I heard this on Russian television evening news, because they're repeating each other. It's particularly true for Tucker Carlson, who's kind of been a darling, or at least he was, and he would be featured almost nightly on certain Russian television, primetime Russian television shows as a hero for them. Here's the one difference, though, Brooklyn, and I want to point this out. So on the Republican side, they tend to support Putin because they think it's in their interests and they like to blow up the model, right? And this appeals to a lot of Americans. Hey, we've just gone for decades, century, realizing Russia's kind of become our enemy, the Cold War, they work against us. Why don't we question that? That's Tucker Carlson's line is, hey, what's wrong with questioning status quo? I love questioning the status quo. I happen to have, however, a lot of inside knowledge on the Russian target. And I know they're enemies of ours, and they've never stopped. But here's the distinction. So Republicans supporting Putin in Russia, yeah, it's against Biden. Yeah, they don't want to spend money. They're fiscally conservative. Okay. They're questioning. Okay, I got it. The difference on the Russian side is they're about sowing absolute chaos and discord in the United States. They're more about chaos and discord and polarizing us than they are about supporting Biden versus Trump. Yes, they support Trump. Yes, the Robert Mueller special counsel inquiry, and yes, the Senate Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee actually found very strong findings that Russia was helping Trump, or at least trying to. That's not the point. The point is they are sitting back and laughing at the discord. Republicans think they're helping their cause, supporting their guy, repeating Russian points. Russia's like, yeah, now we're just about tearing the U.S. apart.
So I watch this stuff a lot, you know, like, for instance, that Tucker Carlson interview we all saw. It just boggled my mind. It was a shameless regurgitating of Russian talking points. And the same goes for members of Congress. And I sometimes wonder, like, why can't our law enforcement step in and say, you know what, these people, and identify who it is, these people are considered a threat to national security. And I'm talking about these members of Congress who seem to have been compromised. For lack of a better word, I mean, they do seem blatantly compromised. They're leaning all the way against United States interests. Why is there no mechanism in place to check them?
Wow, entire books have been written by on this topic of our own freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, are actually creating our greatest vulnerabilities. And I don't want anybody to read this as me saying that we should get rid of freedom of speech or freedom of assembly. I'm absolutely not. I for 25 years, I worked under an oath that I took when I raised my hand and became an FBI agent to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And I still operate on that. But people need to understand when they complain, as you pointed out, my God, can't somebody do something, that we're running smack into civil liberties, constitutional rights to speak freely. Yes, you shouldn't be yelling fire in a crowded theater if there's no fire. And you could be held liable for that if people are injured. But our system doesn't allow, nor would I say that we want a society where FBI agents are knocking on your door because they want to stop you from interviewing Vladimir Putin. Now, they might knock on your door, or another three-letter agency might knock on your door and say, hey, what did you learn while you were in Moscow? Because, you know you were followed, you know you were bugged, you know your phone call and, you know, your phone was retrieved and intercepted and blah, blah, blah. But we don't want to live in society where particularly our media and our elected officials are somehow constrained by a bureaucracy that wants to weigh in on who the people elected or who the people watch on their social media. It's really problematic. You know where what it comes down to is with regard to our elected officials that we think are posing a threat or bought off? It comes down to voting against them and voting them out. With regard to media personalities, it comes down to not watching them anymore, not supporting them anymore. That's where we are. A colleague of mine at MSNBC, who's a legal analyst, Barbara McQuaid, she wrote a book. It came out, gosh, maybe it's been 2 months. I don't know. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's called Fight From Within. I hope I got that title right. I've read it. It's really good.
That's the first plug of the show, even before your own book.
I know. Well, because it's on topic. It's about how we fell into this disinformation propaganda mess. And she actually says early in the book, hey, our vulnerabilities here are also some of our best strengths, which is our freedoms. And we, you know, it gets into the larger question of how you fight domestic terrorism when we don't want big brother government getting informants inside of your backyard barbecue on weekends to see who's talking about whom, right? It's a mess. It's a mess. And I will tell you this, China and Russia look at this, and other countries, Middle Eastern countries, have actually asked me the same question, like, hey, don't you have too much freedom over there? You know, you can't control your people. And I go, well, the goal is not to control our people. However, the goal is to preserve our democracy. And there's the rub.
Frank, you bring up a very, very good, very solid point. I don't feel ashamed for asking you the question, but I feel like I should be ashamed. But I mean, I look at it like this, right? Cigarette smoking was for a long time just generally accepted as A-OK. There were pregnant women who were smoking, no problem, fine. And then somebody learned that, oh, there are dangers to cigarette smoking. So the best we could do in this free society was put a warning, yeah, a Surgeon General warning, yeah, on the box saying, right, warning, you could die if you keep if you keep doing this shit. So I guess I'm lamenting the fact that we can't slap a Surgeon General warning on these traitorous activities.
I like your analogy or metaphor here. I like it because what I say about social media, which by the way is something like 80 to 90% the blame for this mess, we need to regulate it. We need to regulate it. We need to stop treating it as so-called media and treat it as a public utility that needs regulation. Even the honest CEOs will tell you they're failing at regulating their platforms. We've got an election coming up, and I'm sure the folks at Facebook and Google are wringing their hands. I'm not so sure about Elon Musk, but I'm sure they're trying to get this right, but they also have to balance their business interests and resources. You just can't vet everybody posting, you know, tens of millions of posts a day or more. And yet, when the FBI tries to pay them a visit, right, remember Twittergate, and say, here's how that really went down. The FBI visited a number of platforms and said, we just want to make you aware that we see a Russian organized, a government organized strategy here. They're going to exploit this. These following posts are coming from Russia. They're suspect. Heads up, be aware. They never said, take these down. That's not the government telling, you know, it's not a freedom of speech issue. It's a defense of America issue. We're letting you know. Have a nice day. If you have further questions, please call, you know, here's my business card. That's what happened. People flipped out. Oh my God, the FBI is trying to tell people what to post. No. So if you don't, you know, I tell people this, and I've had this happen in my FBI career. If you're on a surveillance of known bank robbers and you see them casing a bank for a likely robbery, do you not tell the bank? Do you not say you got to beef up your security? We think there's going to be a problem. We don't know when. We don't have enough to arrest these people, but they're looking at you for a robbery. Of course you tell the bank. You'd be liable if you didn't give the bank a heads up. That's what the FBI does with social media platforms. And the reaction across much of America was, no, we don't want you doing that. So, you know, we regulate airlines. You can look up the safety record of your airline. The FAA regulates them, monitors their safety. Why aren't we thinking about doing that for social media platforms? In your cigarette analogy, we have a minimum age to purchase cigarettes now. We have the warning. Why aren't we grading safety and security practices at social media platforms and letting people make up their own minds about it?
Yeah, it's because there are actors in this realm who are being very dishonest, and they're screaming, you know, First Amendment, my First Amendment rights. Really, that's not what it is. There was nobody trying to censor these tweets. They were just trying to inform us, to make us an informed consumer,
if you will. And then you throw in the fact that the Twittergate mess was largely about Hunter Biden's laptop and all of that. And now you really have incensed people. And again, it wasn't the FBI saying the Hunter Biden laptop story is false. It was them saying it might be real, but The Russians are exploiting it. Be careful about where your posts and ads are coming from. That's it.
Absolutely. And frankly, it was way too many dick pics for my tastes.
meaning that there is a certain number within your realm of acceptance.
There's a threshold.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. We won't go there.
But speaking of Russian interference, I read recently that convicted felon Paul Manafort is rejoining the Trump campaign. So for those of you who may not remember, can you unpack the many misdeeds of Paul Manafort and his connection to Russian intelligence operatives?
Oh, God. We don't have enough time, but I will tell you this.
Give us the Reader's Digest version.
If he's under serious consideration to support the Trump campaign. Look, this is the man who led. It was campaign manager for Trump previously. He literally, don't believe me, go look up the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee report on this. Manafort hired as his deputy campaign manager a known Russian intelligence operative. In fact, I'm being kind when I say Russian intelligence operative. The Republican-controlled Senate Intel Committee called him a Russian intelligence officer. Like, holy cow. Okay. Yeah. And don't forget, Manafort provided internal campaign data on key voting precincts, swing states, to the Russians. To the Russians. What was that for? Why would you tell the Russians, hey, these are the following areas we're trying to target and be concerned about, if you didn't think they were going to do something with it? And then in his private life, in terms of white-collar crime and corruption, he's a total fraud. He's a total fraud. So why pick him again? Maybe because Trump thinks it worked. Maybe because Trump thinks he's still tied to Russian intelligence operations. Yeah, we should be questioning that. And any Republican should be saying, why this guy? Can you not find somebody better?
It's so frustrating because I still understand what you're saying about this free society and all. It just feels like we're watching in slow motion. We're watching these bank robbers slowly walk into the bank, you know, with guns, you know, guns akimbo, you know, everybody can see him. There's nobody even attempting to stop this from happening. Or the ones who are trying to stop it from happening are being hampered. And
I have to tell you, what I'm about to say represents kind of a sea change for me over the years, which is here's this 25-year veteran FBI agent, former head of counterintel. And I'm about to tell you, if you think government's coming to the rescue, if you think the court system is going to fix all of this or DOJ or the FBI, I think we've seen this and we know how this plays out. Too little, too late is where we are right now. The only thing that's going to save us is ourselves, and that comes in the form of absolute engagement with the process and not only voting, getting people out to vote, volunteering, running for office, helping with the election process in your local town hall. All of that is us. It's on us.
We are the change we seek, as President Obama said. Yeah. How worried should Americans be about Russian incursion into the 2024 election, and how do we stop it?
So first, let me say that we focus almost exclusively on Russia at our own peril, because recent reporting, including from my outfit, NBC News, has pointed out that the Chinese are already at it, fully engaged in attempting to mess with our next election.
In favor of?
Well, it's chaos again that they want to sow.
Do they not have a preferred winner in this horse race?
I can't discern the preferred winner. I can tell you this, they're totally upset with Biden. If I have to, you know, if you're putting me on the spot and saying who would they prefer right now, I'd say they prefer Trump because they feel he can be bought. You know, the businessman in Trump means that things can be transactional with Trump, and they are very transactional. That, you know, it's kind of a situational approach to everything they do. This benefits you. This benefits me. Let's get it done. Let's not talk about how badly we're ripping off your intellectual property every day online and how we want to take Taiwan and how our goal is to actually overtake you and create the big blue water Navy. Let's just do this business deal. You know, that's Trump. So what we've reported is that they're doing something called spamouflage, which is a new term even for me. That is
gotta write that down.
Yeah, spamouflage. They're pretending to be your favorite news outlet. They literally create a site that looks like, let's say you're a big CNN watcher. Looks like CNN's website to me. I'm getting alerts from CNN, I think. And here comes a story that they've, maybe even a real story, like Marjorie Taylor Greene saying Ukraine's eating babies or something. And they insert it into that mainstream media platform that you watch and online, and you think it's a legit story, and it gets amplified all over. Well, it is true, but CNN didn't put it on their site, or it was in the back page. Now it's on the front page. They're doing this all over the place, including, by the way, in Europe and the UK, and in a big way here. So Chinese are at it. Russians, usually less sophisticated, but they too are taking a lesson from China and other places. So we're gonna see an unprecedented attempt to mess with this election. And I will tell you, and it's not something that I have particular privy, not privy to classified information, but it's been reported. There was one hell of a battle under the table, back of the curtain, between the NSA and the U.S. intelligence community and Russia and other Iran, let's throw Iran and North Korea in there, in the last election to keep our election safe. I mean a 24/7 street fight in the cyber world to keep knocking down these attempts by Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. And we won that battle. But it was a dark, brutal, no holds barred battle in almost cyber warfare type battle. We're going to have that happen again. And the adversary has learned their lesson from that. Like, geez, I think the US government kicked our ass. And maybe we go social media now exclusively. Maybe, they've learned what works and doesn't work. We're in for a heck of a ride between now and November.
How does the emergence, the sudden emergence of AI complicate the situation?
Once again, technology is out ahead of us. It's out ahead of Congress. It's out ahead of legislation. We're always chasing the technology. It's not the other way around. And AI in particular. So President Biden recently issued an executive order telling all his cabinet secretaries and all the agencies, get your hands around AI now and figure this out. And there is proposed legislation. I'll tell you, there are some states that are already ahead of the federal government on such legislation, regarding deep fakes, deep fake video and imagery. We saw this play out in, I believe, New Hampshire during the primary season, where these
robocalls.
Yeah. Robocalls pretending to be the voice of Joe Biden, basically telling people, hey, the primary is kind of meaningless. You don't need to break a sweat and get out to vote in this primary. I'm the guy. We're going to see that far more sophisticated. We're going to see not just phone calls. We're going to see images and videos that will be hard to discern and distinguish as AI. And by the time we do, let's say a video's out for 10 hours before it makes the rounds, the truth comes out that this is fake. And it's a video telling you your local voting precinct is on fire, don't go. Or you got to go vote in another town tonight. Or Biden, here's a video of Biden,
eating off a baby.
Yeah, or falling off a stage or whatever, and it didn't happen. And yeah, the truth will get out, but the damage has been done. That's forever. And the legislation that's being talked about would think about things like digital watermarks to let people know, hey, this is fake. If you sell AI software, Maybe you require identification from people so you can trace back whatever they're doing with it. Maybe on a video, it comes out periodically on screen that this is AI. You know, that's what's being talked about. But we can talk and talk and talk. But the bad actors, they're doing it. They're doing it now.
That's what I worry about. I think about our many conversations and debates over gun control, gun violence. And one of the things is, well, you know, regular law-abiding gun owners are going to abide by the rules. But our concern is those people who are outside the law who are not going to adhere to any of these gun restrictions. And I guess the same thing applies to, you know, AI, especially. It's still considered kind of like the Wild West out there. There's no real recognized hard set of rules and regulations for operating in this space.
No, we're way behind. Look, our country hasn't even passed a federal domestic terrorism law. People, if you ask the average person on the street, hey, do you think there's a federal law against domestic terrorism? They'll go, of course, there has to be. There isn't any. There's none. It's not illegal, quote unquote, to be a domestic terrorist. You'll also, you know, ask people, hey, does the U.S. government designate certain groups as domestic terror organizations? And they'll go, oh, I'm sure they do. Oath Keepers, Proud Boys. Nope. There's no mechanism to designate a group a domestic terrorism organization. You know, we're right back to how we started the conversation, which is our freedoms sometimes can get in the way of actually addressing a threat fast enough to deal with it. It's mind-boggling.
Frank, I was literally today years old when I learned that very disturbing news that there's no law against domestic terrorism.
No, I mean look at the charges in January 6th with regard to the rioters and the insurrectionists. Trespass, assault on a police officer, theft, vandalism of a federal building, interfering with an act of Congress, stealing Nancy Pelosi's laptop. The most serious charges that have resulted in convictions, thankfully, are the leadership of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, who were found guilty of seditious conspiracy. That's the closest we've come. But let me tell you, that's a gravely serious charge that has to do with using violence to essentially overthrow the government. What we need is a lesser charge of a domestic terrorism, which is, you know, and I point out to people, Brooklyn, that we've got a charge on the books for international terrorism, right? And guess what? We even have a federal definition of domestic terrorism. We just don't outlaw it. And because every time someone, and by the way, every year in Congress, someone tries to propose a domestic terrorism bill. Amy Klobuchar has tried to do it. People in the Senate, the House, never goes anywhere. You know, oh, the FBI missed the threat. Yeah, they missed the threat. But if you think that they could watch and listen to everybody, you're out of your mind. And we don't want that either as a free society. So I'm an advocate, and I've written about this in my regular column for MSNBC Digital. I'm an advocate of getting rid of the demarcation between international and domestic terrorism. If we define these things in the law, why can't we just put them together? It's the use or intended use or threatened use of force or violence to intimidate or coerce a government or civilian population to advance a political cause. Okay. Why do we say, oh, well, you know, you can't do that if you're Al-Qaeda, but, you know, if the Proud Boys do it, that's fine.
Makes no sense.
No.
Makes no sense. Can I switch gears with you for a second? I want to talk about the recent endorsement of Donald Trump for president from the 12,000-member Police Officers Association of Michigan. In your MSNBC column that you referenced a minute ago, you called the endorsement itself shameful and disturbing. Why?
The Michigan Police Officers represents 12,000 police officers in that state. Their leadership decided in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at a Trump rally, to stand in uniform on either side of him, flanking him left and right. Their leader announced that they were supporting Trump for president. I asked the question in this column I wrote, what exactly were you endorsing? Tell me, please. Because I'll get to the response to the on this column in a second. But so that's my simple question. And I point out, look, because what I see in this man that you're endorsing is someone who is facing 88 indictments, 88 charges across four separate indictments, state, county, and federal indictments. I see someone who cheated on their wife after she just gave birth, cheated with a porn star. I see someone who takes the word of Vladimir Putin over the U.S. intelligence community. I see someone, if you want to talk about, you know, law enforcement and who has your back, why don't you talk to the U.S. Capitol Police Union and ask them about the over 200, almost 200 officers injured and assaulted on January 6th at the Capitol. You think Trump has their back? Really? Officers killed themselves by suicide? One had a stroke? You don't think that that's awful, that he's not supporting them? And here's the response I get on social media by a handful of people. They're supporting because he has the back of law enforcement. Capitol, I got a couple of people said, oh, Capitol Police aren't real police. They're security guards. Okay. This man, Trump, he paid off the mortgage of that NYPD officer who got killed. I say, please give me the citation on that. I'm all about facts, because what I've read is this civilian police organization, private organization, they paid off his mortgage. And the response to that was, well, what you don't know is that Trump supplied that money. I go, no, I don't know that. And you need to give me the citation for that. So, and nobody responds, of course. So, you know, police, this will not be the last police organization that supports Trump, by the way. And you'll recall back in his last election, it was Pence who was leading the so-called Cops for Trump rallies across the United States. Huge turnouts. You know, this is Trump saying, hey, if you rough this guy up when you arrest him, that's fine. You know, you don't need to protect the guy's head while you put him in the back of the car. You know, that's the guy. And you want to endorse him? Fantastic. What's the message when the police in Michigan endorse this guy when he's been found civilly liable for rape? Do you think that women, or for that matter, men who get raped in Michigan are going to feel comfortable going to you, sheriff, whoever you are, that stood next to Trump, and report their rape to you when you endorse the man who's a rapist? How about the guy who's saying that brown people are invading us, that, you know, migrants should be shot? You think a brown person who gets the shit beat out of him because he's brown is going to go to the police department that actually endorses Trump? Tell me how this gets your job done. Tell me how that helps your mission.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's disgusting. Frankly, I was shocked to watch. I saw the clip with a wall of officers standing behind him when he called migrant people animals. And why they all didn't leave the stage at that point, it was beyond me, because I don't feel like that makes anybody safer for him to do that.
Exactly. You could see the look of shock on some of the cops in that back row, like, oh my God. You know, but my sheriff is here, my chief is here, you know, and yeah, migrants are animals. He said it twice now. And you think that helps you protect and serve your population? Really? Wow.
How concerned are you about Trump's ability to incite violence in this election, as well as his various criminal cases?
Yeah, since I'm a facts guy, law enforcement guy, I don't need to engage in conjecture. I just have a track record of facts to look at. He has already. And we could be here an hour rattling off everybody from the El Paso Walmart shooter who echoed Trump's language about brown invaders in his postings and writings. We can talk about the Buffalo supermarket shooter who bought into the great white replacement theory that Trump and Fox News and Tucker Carlson have talked about. And talk about the AME church in South Carolina that had their Wednesday night Bible study interrupted by gunfire people killed by a young man who, again, thought the blacks were, you know, blacks were placing us, and all bought into all of that. I've lost track of the number of violent acts that Trump and his rhetoric have incited. There's so many now, Brooklyn, that he can't have any plausible deniability. It used to be that you'd hear the people come on Fox and say, well, he can't possibly be clairvoyant and understand that crazy people are going to be incited by his rhetoric. Oh, well, now we have the record. He's on notice that his words matter. And yes, you can say these people are crazy, but they're his base. And so, how about the guy in Provo, Utah, who the FBI had to shoot because he swung a rifle around at them when they were coming in to arrest him for threatening the life of Joe Biden and others. And they look at his background, big Trump guy, would walk around town in the blue suit, white shirt, red tie, like Trump. And so people are getting themselves killed too. When you say violence incited by Trump, let's please not forget, it includes people willing to die for him. How about the guy who breached security or tried to at FBI Cincinnati field office, came in with a nail gun. His day didn't go well for him. Ohio law enforcement killed him face down in a dirt cornfield. You're willing to die for that. Oh, okay. How about the woman who died inside the Capitol on January 6th? Did she wake up that morning saying, I'm going to die today? No. Was she willing to? Apparently.
Talking about Ashley Babbitt.
Ashley Babbitt, who, everybody sees as a martyr, and they seem not to see the cause and effect relationship to her demise.
I'll tell you, I'm not a fan of guns, but I think if someone were pointing a gun in my general direction and saying, stay out, stay back, I'm pretty sure I would refrain from climbing through the window the way she did. Just common sense.
Yeah, I think when you see people willing to die for a cause, I reminisce about my days working international terrorism in the FBI. I mean, you pay attention when you start seeing people willing to martyr themselves. And that's what we're talking about here. It's a law enforcement officer pointing a weapon at you, trying to protect the leadership of elected Congress. And you think you should be there? Really? Wow. Okay.
Are you seeing an uptick in threats and attacks as well as we get closer to the trials and the election heating up?
Yeah. Yeah. The evidence there is startling. Some of it doesn't make front page because apparently it's happening way too much, but a week doesn't go by where there's not a story of an arrest of someone threatening a judge, prosecutor, staff, a judge's daughter, the attorney general of New York. I'm not kidding. Every week.
You're just talking about the former disgraced president. He's the one threatening these judges and their daughters and families. It's insane.
Which is why a gag order, limited gag orders have to happen. Lives are at stake here. And in a bigger level, on a bigger scale, our court system, our justice system is at stake here. If we can't safely prosecute criminals, alleged criminals, our system falls apart. And that's exactly what Trump wants to happen. He wants it to come tumbling down. He's eroded our institutions. And we've got to fight back in the enforcement of gag orders and arrest people who act on these things. The woman in Texas who left, some of these people aren't rocket scientists. They leave their death threats on voicemail, which is very convenient for law enforcement. Thanks for doing that. Because it will be Exhibit A in your trial. And we're going to arrest you. Guy in upstate New York tried to, left emails. That's very even more the voicemail threatening the judge in New York and Letitia James, the attorney general. You're going to prison. So have a nice day. Go ahead. You're going.
Not the sharpest tools in the drawer. But Should we be concerned that Donald Trump has kind of created a blueprint for skirting the law? Well, I mean, you know, granted, he has a unique combination of he's wealthy, he's connected, he was a former president. He has a ton of experience, you know, maneuvering in court. So you can kind of understand how he's been able to delay the process. But it almost feels like if I was a criminal, I'm like, I'd be taking notes. And, you know, if I'm a member of law enforcement or the Justice Department, I'd be concerned that other people are going to try to duplicate what this guy is doing.
This is a great point because it goes to a much larger concern. As you're saying, even if Trump goes away, gets convicted or doesn't win the election, has he now given us the template for how to fight the system in a nefarious way? I say nefarious because I'm all about people exercising all of their rights and privileges. You want to appeal, you want to file motions, you want to use up time. Oh, okay. But there comes a point where you're literally mocking the system and suing. So, for example, suing the judge. This is what, you know, this Trump has just done this. Suing the judge. But what the hell for? And it got shot down. You know, yes, I am concerned about this. I'm not just concerned about it when another candidate or president who wants to be, you know, Trump version two. Tries to lead the country. But as you said, it's a template for white collar criminals. It's a template for a drug cartel leader. Just keep delaying, sue the judge, appeal every goddamn motion, refuse. The other thing is like refuse to cooperate. I've lost track of the number of times where judges in New York and even in the federal cases have said, hey, can you guys agree with the prosecution, get together. You know, the system is not supposed to be adversarial. The system is supposed to seek the truth. And the way it works at many county and state levels is the prosecutors and defense attorneys all are on board with the mission. Let's get to the truth. We're all on the same team of justice. And they work together every day throughout the country, but not here. No, no. Trump won't even play. So we need you to write jury instructions. We need you to agree on something. No, no, we're not even having that discussion. Okay, so judges say, I'll do it myself. It just happened with regard to how jury selection is going to work in New York for the hush money case, right? And I shouldn't call it the hush money case. It's an election interference case, in my opinion, right? So the judge finally said, okay, you guys, you can't play in the sandbox. I'm writing the goddamn jury instructions. This is how I'm going to do it. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Frank, I want to talk briefly about your book, Long Haul. Talk to me about how you came to writing true crime and why this story in particular.
Yeah, thanks for asking. And I had to write this book because I had to get this message out. It's something that I never knew. With 25 years of experience in the FBI, I never knew the FBI had a highway serial killings initiative. I never knew that over 850 women have been murdered alongside our nation's highways, and that the FBI absolutely is convinced that it's the work of multiple long-haul truckers who are serial killers.
Jesus.
Already 25 truckers are imprisoned for multiple murders, but that has not begun to solve the caseload, and the number increases. Even as I was writing the book, there were murders happening that I had to then stop writing and include in the book, which I thought was done, but it wasn't done. And it still happens. I still get alerts whenever a trucker's arrested or suspected in a murder. So what's going on? This is the study of three cultures. So if you're into trucking or ever wondered, what's it like being a long-haul trucker? I rode over 2,000 miles in a big rig, flatbed across the country, just to learn trucking. What's the day like? What's the night like? How does it work today versus, I talked to brand new truckers. I talked to ancient truckers, you know, who've been drove for 40 years. It's a different world today. If you ever wondered what it's like to fuel up, get through a way station, find a place to rest at the end of the night at a truck stop, how to make your deadlines. And it's, boy, it's high tech today. Lat bedding with your big load in the back involves physics and math, weight distribution, points of securement. All of that's there. If you're into true crime and how the FBI profilers, crime analysts, look at these crimes and try to connect the dots, they stop the killing, this book is also for you. If you're into learning about the anti-trafficking organizations and how a young lady can fall into the world of trafficking rather rapidly and the commonalities among these victims, I interviewed women who survived violent encounters with truckers. I also talked to the experts, the two top experts in the nation on street level trafficking. And boy, was it eye-opening, because if you think that the young lady in your family can't ever get recruited into this, it'll never happen to someone in your family, you're dead wrong on that. And I expose how that happens today, particularly online in terms of recruitment. So those are the three cultures in the book. It was a wild ride, eye-opening for me, and I think it will be for many others as well.
I can't wait to read it myself. I mean, I'm on the edge of my seat listening to. First of all, I'm curious, what was that like doing the long haul thing in the truck? They have beds in their trucks, right?
Oh, I slept in the top bunk of the sleeper berth in back of the cab, and let me tell you, it's not the Ritz-Carlton. And if you want to relieve yourself, you're going to be doing it in a gallon jug on the road. We were also, the guy I rode with, by the way, was a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. He had been a chef. We ate in the rig. We cooked breakfast in the rig, some dinners in the rig. He had a hot, a hot plate stove in there. And it's eye-opening, just the process of finding an open spot at a truck stop at night is arduous. And you can see why trucks park on ramps and alongside the highways. And then on the trafficking side, loading the rig, this was a flatbed. As I say, there's different kinds of truckers and different kinds of trucks. I even get into, in the book, I get to into theory on who's doing the killing, because when you're so engaged with your load as a flatbedder who has to load and unload, figure out the straps and chains of the load, the right federally mandated points of securement, you have to talk to people when you pick up and when you deliver. You have to load, unload, and tarp. That's a different guy or gal than the guy who's what they call a dry vanner, who's just delivering a load of Kleenex or salsa across the country, talks to no one. His physical activity on any given day consists of opening the back door, right? So the load keeps unloaded. That's it. That's a different trucker. So we get into the different kind of hierarchies of trucking and who's going into it and the nature or nurture question. Are you headed to trucking as a career because you have a proclivity for violence? Or is it exacerbated by your life on the road, isolated, terrible, diet, and sedentary lifestyle? Get into all of that in the book.
Wow. That is extremely fascinating. Fun fact, about 15, 20 years ago, I at one point wanted to get a CDL, become a truck driver. I did, because I do love driving. And I had heard that it's actually quite lucrative if you do like the really long hauls.
Oh, yeah. You're talking so. So I'll take you off my suspect list, but I will say that you're right. You're talking six-figure salary for sure. There's a good future, I think, in the young truckers. I like what I saw, and I dedicate my book, first page, to the stalwart American trucker who puts food on our table. We're talking about a very small handful of truckers who are killing and giving the rest of the industry the bad name. But our economy is built on trucking, man. Grocery stores would stop selling things in 3 days if truckers stopped
they're considered, you know, first responders, at least, you know, during the pandemic. If not for them, there would have been way more stores with completely empty shelves and no food.
Yeah, essential workers for sure, critical to our economy. I enjoyed my time on the road. It's not for me. I do enjoy driving, but not for me. It was an interesting time. It really was. The other thing I learned is, my God, I will never try to get out ahead of a truck on the highway or think that they can stop. For me, they can't stop. I mean, it fully loaded, we were at 80,000 pounds. And, you know, the driver had his foot on the pedal all the way down to the floor. And we were going like 30 miles an hour. They can't stop for you. We had so many near misses when I was riding, because people are stupid. People on their phones while you're around a truck. Are you kidding me? So give them wide berth is all I can say.
I hate passing trucks. I do hate passing them on the highway. I don't like that feeling of I can't see anything on the side of me.
I learned, Brooklyn, is I can now look at a truck, a flatbed, and tell you whether it's properly secured or not, and I won't get behind the truck. I'll get away. If I look at the securement and go, oh no, don't like that, then I'm out of there.
Can I play profiler for you and see if you think my guesses are right about the kind of person that would be a serial killing truck driver?
Let's give it a shot.
It's a loner, but it's someone with a high emotional IQ. Because one of my daughter's friends, her father is a truck driver, and I pick his brain all the time, right? And the name of the game for him is getting from point A to point B as quickly as possible and then getting back, and preferably, hopefully, having something on the way back. So it's a crime, I believe, of opportunity. These guys aren't spending like 2-3 days in one town. They're there. And they have to be able to find their victim relatively quickly, do what it is that they have to do, and then get out. So it's somebody who is very personable. It's not, you know, it's a loner, but somebody who can mingle in a crowd easily. It's a sociopath, I think.
So this is interesting that you use the phrase emotional IQ. We know... And I may differ with you on that part. We know that generally speaking, many serial killers have higher IQs generally, not necessarily emotional IQs. There have been charmers, as you alluded to. Ted Bundy was a charmer, no question about it. But I have to tell you, the cases that I've studied and are in the book, there's almost zero emotion to the killing. There are cases in the book where a killer trucker, would leave a dead body in the car and go take a shower at the truck stop, could eat a sandwich while girls bleeding out,
Jesus,
in the rig, torture chambers, girls in shackles in the back of the rig, state trooper pulling a truck over, Robert Ben Rhodes, the truck stop killer, had a woman shackled in the back. Trooper sees her screaming naked in the back. There's one trucker who, Delmas Colvin, who's been interviewed and said, I sleep just fine at night. They say when you look a woman in the eyes before you kill her, you never forget her. Not me. I didn't feel anything. It's over fast. It's over fast. But they're exploiting the transient nature of their victims and the transient nature of the truck, because they will grab a woman in one jurisdiction, they'll kill her in a second jurisdiction, and they'll dump her in a third jurisdiction. That's where the law enforcement challenge comes in. Where did this happen? Who's working the case? Do we even have detectives in this little county sheriff's department to work the case? That's where the FBI's initiative comes in.
Wow. How close is law enforcement to solving these killings?
Here's the problem. Just when they grab somebody and say, oh, thank God, he's good for this one. And then they find out, no, alibis for all of them. He wasn't there. That's not our guy for these other ones. The other thing is garbage in, garbage out with regard to the FBI special database to where police departments are supposed to enter their unsolved homicides, particularly trucker-related highway homicides. There's a special database the FBI has. If you talk to some of these police departments, they'll tell you, we don't have the time. You know, this is a long form. It's a federal form. It's asking us, did the girl have blue eyes or brown eyes? Was she duct tape around her head or around her ankles or both? Was she naked or partially clothed? Was she in the water or under a tree? We don't have time and we don't have anybody to do it. And the FBI says, we can help you do it, right?
Right.
But if you don't enter the data, the FBI folks back at Quantico, Virginia, can't connect those dots.
Yeah, that data is important.
Yeah. It's crucial. It's crucial. Yeah.
Frank, thank you. Thank you so much. The name of that book is Long Haul. What's the subtitle? Well,
it's Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon or anywhere you buy your books. Publishers HarperCollins. And hey, maybe a movie someday. Who knows?
Yeah, I would watch it. I definitely would watch it, but I would definitely read the book first because I'm sure I will enjoy it more than the movie. I don't want to leave our listeners on the note of highway murders, so I want to ask you: are there safeguards in place right now to protect our 2024 election against interference? And the reason I'm asking this is because in 2020, we were told that that was the safest election in history, or at least in modern history. I want to know, do we have that same kind of safeguard in place for 2024?
I'm happy to report that the federal government is all over this, and Department of Homeland Security and CISA, the agency within DHS that's responsible for cybersecurity, as they were last time, are coming alongside state, local, county election officials and helping them secure their own. So there's actually a beauty in the system. You know, sometimes you sit there and go, God, I wish the elections were controlled by the federal government. We could easily put all kinds of mandated cybersecurity requirements, right? We could, you know. The problem with that is that there's a single point of failure if you do that, and that would be the federal government. Not the first time the federal government would have been hacked. So the seemingly chaotic system we have, where every state uses different voting machines and different counties do different things and paper ballot and electronic ballot, and that actually there's some beauty in that because there is no single point of failure. Wisconsin, but maybe they don't get Michigan. And the government coming along and helping, I think, is going to help us win the day. My concern, Brooklyn, is violence at a local level. If they don't like the outcome, threats against the people counting the vote, it's going to be close, I think. And then, again, not accepting the results, just simply not accepting the results, even if it's a blowout. You know, well, it's rigged, and here we go again. Here we go again. That's what I'm concerned about.
So our biggest threat is not even from without, it's from within.
I think so, and it remains so. Nothing's changed in terms of the domestic threat.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us on the Defiant podcast. I really enjoyed learning from you and also learning about your book, Long Haul. I can't wait to read it. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for what you do. It was a great discussion.
It's a pleasure. Before we go, I nearly forgot that today marks the start of Donald Trump's hush money trial. As much as we gnash our hands that this man is seemingly Teflon in his ability to evade accountability, he must now face the music for his crimes. If convicted, Trump could face more than a decade in prison. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Each count carries a maximum sentence of 4 years. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all counts in the case, which focuses on whether he falsified business records to cover up reimbursements to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, for a $130,000 hush money payment to Daniels. Daniels has said she had a sexual encounter with Trump soon after Melania Trump gave birth to their son, Barron Trump. Trump denies the claim. In order to secure felony convictions, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office has to convince a 12-person jury that Trump falsified the records in order to commit or conceal another crime. In this case, Bragg argues Trump was trying to conceal a federal campaign finance law violation by falsely recording his reimbursements to Cohen as payments for legal services. The federal violation was a limit exceeding contribution to Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, as the payment was allegedly designed to keep Daniels' story from hurting the then Republican nominee's election prospects. Bragg also alleges Trump was trying to conceal a plan to violate New York tax and election laws. Here's the thing. Even if this guy is found guilty and sentenced to prison, there's nothing in the Constitution preventing Donald Trump from becoming president. So my point here is that we can't count on the courts to get rid of Donald Trump. We have to win at the ballot box and deny him a second term. He'll use these trials to make the case to his MAGA base that he is some kind of martyr and political prisoner. It's all nonsense, but that's what we're dealing with. There's no scenario where these folks suddenly see the light and turn on Orange Jesus, banishing him to Mar-a-Lago. Not gonna happen. And that's why we're here, to keep our eyes on the prize. Don't get mad, get defiant. And that's me signing off. Peace.